Hello, and welcome to the Reason Roundtable. This is the podcast of free minds, free markets, and free takes. I'm your host, Peter Suderman. Sad news this Easter Monday, Pope Francis has died. Francis' papacy began in 2013. He was perceived as a progressive, transformative figure for the Catholic Church, not always in ways that pleased his conservative critics. So this is somewhat outside our usual ambit on this podcast, unless, of course, Stephanie Slade is here. But the Catholic Church is a major world institution with implications for politics. Notably, J.D. Vance, Vice President of the United States, was in Rome to speak with the Pope this weekend. So what are your thoughts on his legacy and passing? Matt Welch, let's start with you.
I think I'm the only person who even sporadically attends a Catholic church. And weirdly enough, he just didn't come up in the last 10 years. But that's very idiosyncratic towards the local church that I go to. He was the Pope of inequality. He was the Piketty Pope in many senses. And you look at the Reason's archives from 2015, we get a lot of that. I would single him out for one piece of criticism that'll probably get lost today, is that after the Charlie Hebdo massacre, he talked a lot about how, well, you can't just insult religions. That was not a robust response. I'm sure other people will have some things to say about his views on capitalism. But at least he lived to a ripe old age of 88. And my heart's out to people who are mourning him today.
Nick Gillespie.
I was not fond of Pope Francis because he criticized capitalism more than he criticized Fidel Castro. And I think that's a tremendous failing when you consider him in the shadow of somebody like John Paul II, who was equally theologically serious and conservative, if that's your bag, because Francis was a theological conservative. JP engaged the world in a way that made more people more free to worship God as they see fit.
All right. Catherine, what do you think?
I'm just happy that he managed to see one last 420.
An Easter 420. All right.
It's an important convergence for a certain kind of libertarian, especially young lady libertarians at Reason. Lots of young Catholic lady, some of them partakers of the cannabis. So
that's
happy
true.
420.
There is an overlap here between the 420ers and the Catholics. All right. We've got a big show coming up. We're going to dig into Trump's deportation policy and the legal and political dramas around it, changing tone amongst liberals. We're also going to talk about the White House's escalating conflict with Harvard. We've got a listener question about Trump and Obama in a street fight. And we're going to discuss the latest on Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth and artificial intelligence. Is AGI finally here? And what does that mean for Matt Welch's tech troubles specifically? Okay, to talk about all of this, we have our usual gang of illustrious colleagues, Catherine Mangu Ward, Nick Gillespie, and Matt Welch, who's fresh off another successful appearance on Bill Maher. Everyone say hello.
Howdy.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, happy Monday to everybody who opened their HBO Max app to watch The Last of Us and ended up watching Matt Welch instead. Do you have anything to report? Highlight reel?
Just it's fun as always to go there. It's always great to be introduced to U.S. senators that you hadn't previously heard of.
That is the
Tina,
most awkward.
Tina Smith.
She was actually great. Yeah. We had a,
you're
had
like,
a good time.
What is it you do here?
Matt, that's what it's like great. To live in Washington all the time.
Yeah.
She dropped
a couple
of F-bombs.
Did she?
In the overtime segment at the very least, which I don't associate with Minnesota Nice.
This
she's,
is the thing
she's
now.
She's not running for re-election, so.
Yeah.
Democratic consultants are telling Democratic politicians to swear more because it makes them seem more authentic and more authentically angry in the era of Trump.
I'm going to swear less. Everything about what just happened in that sentence. Some of us swear authentically. We don't need consultants for that.
Yeah. I'm willing to get a fee to tell people to curse more, but.
All right. We have a great big show with a lot of maybe authentic swearing coming up for you. But we're going to have to break for an ad first. But first, do you want to work for the Reason Roundtable? We're looking for a producer. If you want to help make the Reason Roundtable happen, send a cover letter and a resume to jobs@reason.com. That's jobs@reason.com.
We're nice. Come work with us.
Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners, Peter Suderman here. Do you know a student looking for a transformative opportunity that supports the foundations of a free society? Reliance College invites students age 16 to 24 to the 2025 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago from July 26th to August 2nd. This year's theme, Reason and Free Will, dives into timeless ideas from writers such as Thomas Jefferson, Ayn Rand, and Aristotle. Students can sharpen critical thinking skills in small dynamic groups, developing the intellectual tools needed to thrive in a free society. Outside the classroom, they will explore Chicago's vibrant culture, touring museums, trying improv comedy, and building lifelong personal connections. Parents, this program equips students to think, reason, and act independently. Go to reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. Registration is just $800, including room and board for the full week with scholarships available. Don't miss out. Visit reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. That's reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. All right, we are going to talk in great detail about Trump's deportations and detainments today. There was a lot of news last week, much of which we will get to shortly. But beyond the news, I think something has changed in the tone and the tenor of the discussion about Trump, especially from his critics on the left. But not only. The left is increasingly alarmed. Ezra Klein of The New York Times is warning that the emergency is here. On MSNBC, Chris Hayes is saying that Trump is trying to take away the liberties at the core of the American experiment. And like I said, it's not just progressives. David Brooks, of all people, is calling for an uprising in the streets. And a Reagan-appointed judge wrote that the White House behavior, quote, should be shocking not only to judges, but to the intuitive sense of liberty that Americans far removed from courthouses still hold dear. I know at least some libertarians are concerned as well. At the same time, one of the things that I always hear from listeners to this podcast is that they like that we keep our cool, even when everyone else is freaking out. So are these folks right to be raising the alarm? I guess I want to start by just asking, what's your personal alarm level,
Catherine?
My personal alarm level was reduced by David Brooks calling for insurrection. Like, I'm being completely serious. Like,
there's like a sleeping pill instead of marching orders.
Yeah, there's like something about the, like, when the New York Times does a style piece, that's like always a sign that that trend is over. Like that cliche, like, David Brooks calling for insurrection feels to me like a sign that insurrection is over. And I don't know what to do with that, because on the one hand, all of the things he describes in that column and the things that Ezra Klein and all these other people are pointing out, they're not good. I too am alarmed by many of the manifestations of Trumpism. At the same time, I just think it might still be LARPing by the pundit class to say, we will be the ones at the barricades. We will be the ones leading the insurrection. I don't think that's how it goes. And so that manifestation of alarmism makes me less alarmed.
Nick, do you think this is pundit class LARPing?
Yeah, probably. The pundit class is less important than the actual nuts and bolts of things like deportation processes and defying court orders, and also misdirecting us away from tariffs and the kind of horrible economic cataclysms or, you know, maelstroms that Trump is plunging us into. So I'm deeply concerned about all of this. I think when it comes to deportations, the big thing is going to be what happens over the next couple of weeks, because the battle lines now are clear. Trump did this in his first term. He always pushes the boundaries and sees, you know, what doors are open that he can walk through. A couple of these doors have been slammed shut. And now the question is, like, does he go back into it or not? And I'm concerned about it because he has never hidden the ball about immigration. And he, you know, talked very proudly and forwardly about mass deportations. Those aren't quite happening yet. He also is failing to deport criminals. When it turns out that 75% of the people that he's sending to El Salvador are not criminals, when their poster boy is a guy who doesn't have any convictions in the United States, something is deeply wrong. And it suggests that they can't find all of these criminals that they say are destroying America. And that's disturbing, as is the idea that, you know, he wants to start shipping homegrown criminals to El Salvador, the Bitcoin paradise you know, where I guess you can buy cigarettes using cryptocurrency, which would be nice.
Nick, I will just say, because our commenters will tell us if I don't, that the people who are sort of saying it's not that big a deal that this guy Garcia was deported will point out that there was a police report alleging gang membership or some sort of connection to a gang here, even though he does not have any actual criminal convictions either here or in his home country. We'll talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, and the Trump administration admitted in court filings that deporting him to El Salvador was an oversight on their part. They should not have done it. So we shouldn't get into the weeds too much, other than that you have an administration that is pushing the envelope on what is legal or not, according to these courts. And I think what happens over the next couple of weeks will really be when we go up, you know, to whatever. What was the highest threat level during the global war on terror? Red or magenta?
It just seemed like it was always orange, so I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I lost the cones and rods in my eyes. I could no longer see color. But we're in a
First
bad
all,
place
that's
and considerably
racist
against dogs who can't see color. Matt, how's your intuitive sense of liberty here?
Phenomenal, as always. I can't believe that you would even question that, sir.
I just want an update, you know? Got to check in.
Matt's Liberty.
Make sure it's
Matt's
still
Liberty
there.
Dar.
The White House is shipping residents of the United States to authoritarian prison hellholes overseas in direct defiance of the judiciary branch. That's bad. Also, in deporting a bunch of students from college campuses for doing things like writing op-eds and participating in protests. Also bad, even though that's probably more legal. It's not in defiance. The Marco Rubio does have some authority, too much authority, under the 1952 Immigration Naturalization Act. However, all of this is bad. What I take as a positive is not anything that Ezra Klein says, although you got your quota, so I'm happy for you, but rather that 80% of Americans consistently, when they're asked, do you think that the president should follow Supreme Court rulings, even ones he really disagrees with, the answer is yes. Per Nick's comment earlier, Americans are very strong, more than 80%. I think it's more like 85% say, sure, you should deport. Actually, 97% say you should deport violent criminals. And I think a solid majority says criminals, period. But 85% say you should not deport illegal immigrants who have jobs, who are married to U.S. citizens or who are the parents of U.S. citizen children. That's what Trump is doing right now. There are American citizens in the Southwest, U.S. citizens, being stopped, asked for their papers, unable to produce them, and being thrown in the clink for 10 days until they get spirited out. We are in a bad place for that, but Trump is going up against 80 to 20 issues with the American people, thinking, for some reason, that let's get an MS-13 type guy and let's doctor the pictures of him showing MS-13 tattooed on his knuckles, which it isn't, and that somehow that'll be popular for them. I don't think it will. I think the intuitive sense of liberty lies in the population. The pundit class is largely irrelevant. American people are not irrelevant. And at a time when the stock market, as of the last time I glanced at it, is 12% down since Inauguration Day, there's going to be a lot of reasons to look around and say, what are we doing here? I think the intuitive sense of liberty is strong. It will eventually, probably sooner rather than later, bite Trump on the butt as Republicans see what a wipeout they're shaping themselves up for in the 2026 midterms.
Yeah, I think the fact that judges are saying this stuff, and especially Reagan-appointed, quite conservative judges who have long track records of not being kind of squishy liberal types, that tells us that this isn't just pundit LARPing. There is also there's also real concern sort of in the corridors of power, but just kind of with anybody who's paying attention. And that's, I think, why my personal alarm levels have increased over the last week, because every day it just looks more and more like the Trump administration is intent on flouting the rule of law. And the case that Nick mentioned of Kilmar Armando Abrego Garcia is instructive because he was deported to this horrible Salvadoran prison facility. I think he's no longer in it, but CSAT, which is, people have sort of compared to a gulag or a torture prison. And like Matt said, by the administration's own, maybe it was Nick, but as was mentioned, by the administration's own admission, it was a mistake. It was an administrative error, right? And so Garcia, yes, he's an illegal immigrant. He's been accused of being a gang member. There's court records that were circulated last week that show that his wife alleged domestic violence, although she now says they worked that out privately, whatever that means. He is in many ways not a sympathetic character. It just doesn't matter. Doesn't matter at all, like whether or not he's a good guy, because the administration didn't follow the law, because the government made a mistake. And when the Supreme Court ordered the Trump administration to facilitate Garcia's return, Trump just shrugged, saying effectively, not much we can do. And maybe in this specific case, there isn't much to be done about Garcia. It would be maybe hard to get him back. But at a minimum, what the administration can do is stop pursuing deportations without due process. And they're not doing it. And the Supreme Court actually had to issue a rushed order on Saturday morning, pausing deportations under the Alien Enemies Act. Trump, meanwhile, like you guys said, raised the possibility of deporting U.S. citizens, homegrowns, right? This isn't just deportation either. You're not just going to another country to live a new life. This is imprisonment in a harsh foreign prison facility. So I want to just ask Catherine, we've got listeners and viewers who are more hawkish on immigration, right? Who are going to argue Garcia was here illegally. There are court records that paint an unflattering picture of him that his deportation just isn't that big a deal. What do you say to all that?
I mean, I think part of it is just the answer that you've already given, which is Trump has said, I'm not only applying these standards to non-citizens. I might apply these standards to citizens. I'm not only applying these standards to gang members. I'm going to apply them to college students that I just think kind of suck. Like, it's already clear that there is a slippery slope, not in the kind of rhetorical way, just in actual escalation of the cases. And I think that the level of response from the Supreme Court, the sort of very, very quick stay on the blocking new deportations under the Alien Enemies Act is it signals the seriousness of what's happening here. And we're going to get a lot of back and forth this week about, did the Supreme Court act too precipitously? Is that going to end up causing a backlash, et cetera, et cetera? I think that's all kind of like second order consideration. The first order consideration is still just like, even if you think that the particular people being deported are bad, we have already been told explicitly, and we have already seen happening, that it won't just be bad people that this happens to, or at least not just those types of bad people. So that's my best case for people who are skeptical.
Nick, the other argument here is, or another argument anyway, is that deporting people like Garcia, this is just making up for Biden's refusal to crack down on border crossings when he was in
office. Let in 600 billion people. What are they saying at this point?
If you watched the Alex Norestra discussions, right? So he's out there arguing against deportations and stuff, just arguing with all the critics on X this weekend. And just amazing that he's like, starts with like, it's like 10 or 11 million people here illegally. And then it became 40 and then 50. And he was like, somebody give me 100. Somebody earnestly and honestly was just like, yeah, I think no kidding. It's like 100 million people. Totally baseless estimates, nothing to do with reality. But look, you have said the Biden administration allowed border chaos. So is this in any way a reasonable response to Biden's border chaos and his policies?
It is a political response. It is not a reasonable response. The fact is that Biden in his last year and Trump so far has managed the border pretty well. That is not where the plurality of people come in. So it doesn't solve things. But there is something really deeply wrong when, you stop people flowing over the border. That's good. And then you start saying, various college students, various people who graduate from college and would be staying here otherwise, have no pathway to staying in the U.S. and being productive, paying taxes, becoming citizens eventually, because they they want to live here. The larger problem with all of this is Trump's general attitude towards immigration, which is overtly hostile, whether it's legal or illegal. Every once in a while, he and sometimes Elon Musk will be, oh, you know what, if we can get, you know, the people with really potent sperm and great SAT scores, we'll let them come in. You know, but then they never do anything about that. We need to have that broader conversation about immigration, why it is important to America, why it is good for America in the present, why it is an integral part of our past, our present, and especially our future. You know, America is an idea, and America does best when people from all over the world want to work here, and they come here, they pay taxes, they raise their kids, they build businesses, and they create the next iteration of what it means to be American. This is the conversation we need to be having, not haggling over, you know, ludicrous estimates that J.D. Vance, you know, on his way to go to the Pope, you know, starts denouncing people because, you know, they're ruining the country that his great grandparents fought, you know, built or something like
with
that.
With their bare
it's
hands.
It's profoundly, profoundly un-American and stupid, and it is a cultural suicide.
Yeah. I also think we're doing this thing where we're doing a very classic prohibition move where we are making people who were in the gray market move into the darkest depths of the black market in terms of immigration. And by that, I mean, you know, Biden had this whole attempt to regularize border crossing and asylum applications. You know, there was an app for that. And it seems clear that they have used all the information in that app to pursue deportations or some already and maybe more. And there's discussion last week of maybe using IRS records for people who are, you know, on various legal statuses, but have been paying their taxes, have been interacting with the IRS. We might end up in a situation where the Trump administration is using those records. All of this sends a very, very clear message to people who are here or who do want to come here, which is if you come here, stay as far off the radar as you can, because you simply cannot trust that the next administration will treat you as the current administration says it will in either direction. That becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. If everybody who comes here with any kind of dubious legal status or overstays a visa or anything like that stays in the darkest, darkest black markets, you do see more lawlessness. You do see more crime. You do see fewer economic contributions to the government. You do see kids who are maybe not enrolled in school and get put on a bad pathway. Like, all the bad things that people believe about immigration and especially illegal immigration become more true based on the acts of this administration.
Yeah, if you want to integrate and assimilate people, then this is not the way to do it. Matt, go ahead.
I think it's important to reiterate that the administration could deport Garcia, not tomorrow, but pretty quick, bring him back from El Salvador, and then deport him to any country not named El Salvador, since that was the one named by judges in America saying you can't deport him there. He's deportable, according to that. In fact, the Trump administration could have done that in 2019, back when Trump was the president and Garcia's case was in front of judges back then. It's clear by both Trump's actions and the White House's actions, and also for their cartoonishly 11-year-old social media presence, where they're red-penning New York Times headlines about this case and saying, you know, Pam Bondi's not going to let him in, ha, that kind of stuff, that they relish to have a test case so that they can expand their power and also expand their sense of being able to do whatever they want, regardless of the Supreme Court. And Damon Root wrote a really good piece late last week for Reason website, Reason.com. It's a great one. You should check that out. Talking about how the Supreme Court doesn't have guns. And in fact, there have been times in the past when presidents or governors, in the case that he was talking about, Brown versus the Board of Education, George Wallace said, OK, great. Good luck trying to enforce that one. It's only over time and with public opinion that the Supreme Court's decisions in those cases begin to gain the kind of legitimacy that works. So I think Trump is playing a dangerous game, but he's doing it definitely, definitely on purpose in such a way that those who are making pragmatic arguments about what are you going to do, sir, about deportations? Well, if you want to deport this guy, bring him back and deport him. You can do that. They're choosing not to.
So speaking of the White House's social media behavior, J.D. Vance, I guess while he was traveling to Rome, was also arguing with none other than Jesse Singel. Jesse Singel, a Reason contributor, host of a great podcast, a good newsletter, a friend of Reason. We don't always agree with him, but have published him. He's a good guy. And J.D. Vance got in an argument with Jesse Singel about whether or not you, about a single tweet that basically said you either have to be stupid or disingenuous, verging on lying, in order to defend a bunch of this stuff when it comes to the deportations. And Vance responded, none of these people can articulate a deportation standard that, one, would satisfy left-wing critics of the administration's immigration policy, two, would satisfy their intuitions about what due process is required, three, would be workable given resource constraints, and four, would permit deportations of most of the illegal immigrants allowed under Joe Biden's administration. They want to nullify the results of a Democratic election. It's that simple. Doesn't seem like it's that simple.
Do you get the impression in the airport he beat up a bunch of Hare Krishnas on the way to go meet the Pope too? I mean, he's just a very angry guy.
It is that simple, though, in a way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's pretty
simple.
It really
is that simple. This one trick.
Okay, let me make this even simpler, because I feel like I'm missing something in this tweet, which supposedly explains what the administration is doing. Where is the part where Vance makes the case that the Trump administration's actions are lawful and constitutional?
He's not making that case. I mean, that's just, it's clear. He's not making that case.
He is pointedly not making that case.
He's actually, in further tweets in that day's exchange, which also was with Zaid Gilani and other people on our very online politics now, he used due process in scare quotes, which is pretty great from a sitting vice president. No, what he's doing, and this is where I agree with him, is he's calling Jesse Singel smug, which Jesse definitely is. And that first tweet that he was responding to actually was a little bit like it. And I say that having upbraided Jesse in public recently about just that. But what he's doing is it's really interesting for all these people who allegedly hate neocons, right? J.D. Vance and Donald Trump, actually some of the more, winning things about them is how much they went after the Bush dynasty and went after neocons, and they hate all that kind of stuff. Okay. But it's so weird how you're doing extraordinary rendition and you're like trying to get rid of habeas corpus and you got black sites abroad and you're telling people that you're either with us or with the terrorists. Like they're playing all of those greatest hits, 2003, 4, 5, Bush, Cheney, White House stuff. And back then, oftentimes, it was lonely. And sometimes the commenters would get mad when libertarians would say, hey, that's bad. I won't use a curse word because we don't do that anymore. We're not advised by Democratic Party strategists. But that's bad. And civil libertarians rightly understand that that's bad. And he's trying to point to the scoreboard and say, we won the election. You know, what are you doing? Why do you love terrorists? And it's just appalling. This is really middle school type of argumentation.
And it's built on that assertion of 20 million. Or whatever, which shows up everywhere but the actual ICE and DHS documents that the Trump administration is now compiling. So, that is one of the problems with online kind of politics and whatnot, and particularly the way that Trump and Vance et al. Do things, is where every statement, nests within it like 30 different things, all of which are either completely wrong or mostly wrong. And so then do you kind of engage the conclusion, or do you start by saying, there aren't 20, Biden did not allow 20 million illegals to come here and who are living here, on top of the 11 million, which is the figure that is mostly, most used by most sources. So where do you go from that? But it's an effective politics strategy, but it is going to lose in the court of reality, as well as, I suspect, very clearly in actual legal courts in America.
Yeah. And I mean, that sort of argumentation also just filters down, I think, in worrying ways. You have Republican Texas Representative Brian Babin, who's like the co-chair of the Border Security Committee or something, tweeting that like Bukele fired activist judges and took his country back. We should take notes. No, we shouldn't. We should not take notes and do what Bukele did. That is not the right way to go about all of this. And it's really disturbing that you see this not just in the idiot pundits like Jesse Kelly and not just sort of in the online discourse, but that that style of thinking has filtered all the way up through Congress and into the White House now in a way that is pretty disturbing. All right, let's move on and talk about another battle that Trump is having with Harvard, which is sounding its own alarms after the Trump administration's anti-Semitism task force sent the school a letter laying out a series of demands. Ivy League school said it was gonna resist. Trump administration is pausing billions in grant funding to Harvard. Reports say the IRS is considering revoking Harvard's tax status. Catherine, you don't mind the Trump administration pulling billions in funding from really anything, do you?
So here is my main critique here, which is no one should have been funding Harvard in the first place. And I know that that's easy enough to say from my comfy little vantage point, but this has always been the case against federal funding of anything, is if you can fund it, you can defund it. And if you can defund it, that's the same thing as heavily regulating it or, abolishing it. This is a horrible, horrible dynamic, which we dove into headfirst and exacerbated on many, many fronts. Same thing with the tax status. I say this as someone who is the editor of a magazine that is a 501c3. And you know what I don't love? That it's an existential threat, that could be taken away at any time. But the ideal would be a neutral tax code that doesn't give these carve-outs and doesn't dump extra money and therefore does not have all of these levers to control everything everyone does.
I just want to push you just a little bit. I get that you think that Harvard shouldn't have, the federal government shouldn't have funded Harvard to begin with. What should be done now?
Yeah. So now I think it's going to be trench warfare. And I think that's bad for everyone. Now it's going to be...
Yeah, trench warfare is usually a real...
Not if you've graduated college.
Yeah. Now it's going
Sorry,
to be
Matt.
this complicated back and forth. We already saw this with Columbia, where they made some concessions and it was this is reasonable and it's some checks on excesses. And then immediately the Trump administration says we're going to push harder on Harvard. The things that Harvard was asked to concede were substantially more onerous than what Columbia was asked to do. And it will just continue in that way. And so I think Harvard has to fight, and they have to fight on this very, very, I guess we're just using the trench warfare metaphor. They have to fight in this muddy ground. They have to fight in this dubious no man's land where they have to make the argument, which isn't a strong one. We are entitled to billions of dollars of taxpayer money just because we're doing cool stuff with it. It's fine. That's a hard case to make. And it's a hard case to make for everyone, especially hard for Harvard that has quite a lot of money of its own. And I wish they didn't have to fight on that ground. But I don't see any way out besides just the unequal treatment case and the just incremental squabbling for the rest of the Trump administration on many, many, many fronts.
Matt, so about these murmurs that are, I don't know if this is going to happen, but the Trump administration is at least considering trying to revoke Harvard's tax status. I know it's been a while and it's sort of hard to remember history, but you're like a history dad these days, right? And I feel like I recall a time when conservatives were against using the IRS to punish speech. That was bad for a while, right?
Yeah. And the way that the whataboutism is happening right now is kind of instructive, which is that when people rightly criticize the Trump administration for very clearly trying to use whatever is at its disposal, like a weapon to go after perceived political enemies, they'll say, yeah, what about the IRS going after Tea Party organizations? And I understand the critique of media or unequal outrage and all that stuff. I do understand that. And it's worthy to do that sometimes. But also, you didn't like that last thing. So you're doing the bad thing too now? And we're saying everything's equal. It's a very Chris Rufo universe that we're living in. And it's not great. I'm going to say a thing that I think I've never said and probably will never say again, which is good on Harvard for telling the Trump administration to go take a long walk off a short pier. That was the correct thing to do. Harvard has been the worst university in the country when it comes to free speech for a long time. Harvard believes that it just sort of sits in the locus of American power by birthright. And it's just a disgusting institution on every level from my point of view, admittedly, California idiot point of view. But it was good of them to tell the administration to get stuffed. And I think that it's a great time to do the Katherine Mangu Ward thing of like, okay, cool. Can we start the process of separation between the university and state? The time is now. Not necessarily the states, a lot of good state schools out there, and there's a bit of competent governance on the state and local level occasionally when it comes to universities. But the federal government, no, we no longer, because of the absolute degradation of trust and the absolute increase in polarization and weaponization of government. Both parties have done this, not necessarily in equal measures, but both parties have definitely done it. And they've also meddled, Biden administration, Obama administration, have definitely meddled into the affairs of the university on political grounds, even though universities are very collegial towards Democrats. This has all happened, but we just no longer can trust the federal government to be anything like a neutral institution anymore. That is a great opportunity to say, cool, let's get the federal government's fingerprints out of those institutions. I will just inject a long dash. An M dash by saying, I don't really understand what happens with the cessation of all of the research funding that's come from the federal government that goes through universities. I don't understand the negative impacts of it. So I'm speaking out of ignorance about that little part. And it's not a little part, it's a big part. And I'd be very curious to read and hear more about that. But in general, I think that it's time to get the federal government out of the business of universities and vice versa.
There's also been, there's already been, not quite market discipline, but like philanthropic market discipline for university excesses happening very clearly in the last few years, especially about anti-Semitism, right? We have already had a situation where like, did the universities maybe need to, some universities need to hear a message about how they were handling anti-Semitism on their campuses? They did need to hear that message, and they heard it from their private donors. And many universities, I think, held a lot of emergency meetings to try and figure out how to handle that stuff better. We did, like, this is a classic example of, like, government is a lagging indicator and a blunt instrument, and it's not going to accomplish the things that it, at least that task force was supposed to accomplish.
Yeah. I mean, if you look at the demands, it does seem like, I mean, Matt's kind of on the right track thinking about the separation issue here, because one of the Trump administration's demand was that Harvard create an external review body approved by the government that would, quote, audit the student body, faculty, staff, and leadership for viewpoint diversity such that each department, field, or teaching unit must be individually viewpoint diverse. Okay, viewpoint diversity. Not so bad. At the same time, this is basically saying you, Harvard, independent institution, do not have control of your staff and the curriculum. It sounds like a demand for control about who gets taught and like who gets to teach and what, right? Like, Nick, I mean, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. I have an interview that'll be coming out in a couple of weeks with Steven Pinker of Harvard, who where we talk about this kind of stuff. You know, I'm all in favor of separating, you know, the state from everything other than the, you know, the tax dollars that we need to pay in order to fund a, you know, a night watchman state. Having said that, there's also a longstanding tradition of saying if you take a dollar of money from the government doesn't get to dictate all aspects of your behavior. And that's what this is. I mean, and the thing you were talking about, Peter, is the purest case of that. But it's also true that it, you know, it's been rejected that if the government gives a dollar in a student loan or a Pell Grant, they get to dictate what courses are possible to be taught at a particular place or whatever. It is worth, you know, maintaining the continuity between, say, Joe Biden's, you know, Department of Education and all the Title IX bullshit that he larded onto things first under Obama and then as president himself. These are all arguments for separating stuff. But even beyond that, if Harvard wins a competitive grant to do research on pediatric cancers in some of the hospitals that they run, that should not mean that Eric Trump gets to teach a course on Monday about the 1776 Project. And we should, you know, we should just be honest about that. The other thing that I think is fascinating to think about in the larger context is that a decade ago, it was something like 57% of Americans, according to Gallup, had a great deal or quite a lot of trust and confidence in higher education. That number is now at 36%. And it has plummeted, I think, into the low double digits among Republicans. And it's worth kind of puzzling over that. We are seeing, you know, as we're seeing the evacuation of many institutions and kind of structures that have been in place our entire lives and longer, something is happening in higher education across the board. And that's really ultimately on higher education to figure out why people are starting to have a much darker view of it, both, I think, from, you know, kind of ideological for ideological reasons, but also for practical ones. And part of that also has to do with the fact that we are, you know, the population that's going to be going to college, just like the population that's going to K through 12 schooling is falling. There's going to be a major transformation of higher ed over the next 20 years, regardless of who's president.
The funniest part about this is that it appears to have been a mistake. According to a report in the New York Times, the letter was sent in error. And then, of course, the Trump administration has just decided to say, well, you know what, we're going ahead with this, and it's Harvard's fault for responding like this. Pretty telling.
All right, we'll be back. It's the Pee Wee Herman presidency. They meant to do that, Peter.
We'll be back.
I guess not a lot of Pee Wee Herman fans anymore.
After this. Hey, Reason Roundtable listeners. Want to give a student the mindset of a founder? Join the 2025 Great Connection Seminar in Chicago, July 26th through August 2nd. Designed for students aged 16 to 24, this week-long experience builds the core skills of entrepreneurship, critical thinking, persuasive communication, and intellectual independence. This year's theme, Reason and Free Will, explores great minds like Aristotle, Ayn Rand, and Thomas Jefferson, not through lectures, but in dynamic, small-group discussions that train students to lead and innovate. Outside the classroom, they'll tour Chicago's museums, try improv comedy, and connect with ambitious peers. In a world of AI and automation, original thinking is your competitive edge. Tuition is just $800, including room and board. Scholarships are available. Apply today at www.reliancecollege.org/reason. That's www.reliancecollege.org/reason. Okay, we have a listener question from Aaron in Orlando, who describes himself as a libertarian curious progressive who really enjoys the show. Thank you, Aaron. So last week, my pal Jonathan from Calgary, I guess all of our listeners have like a signal group, maybe like a secret chat. They're just talking about stuff, about us on it. Last week, my pal Jonathan from Calgary submitted a question that included some high-minded quote from Thomas Jefferson about executive power and its abuses. I told him I thought it was a bit of a softball. Did he really expect anyone on the round table to disagree with the Thomas Jefferson? He challenged me to come up with a better question. So this one is a two-parter. Number one, who was the better president, Barack Obama or Donald Trump? And number two, who would win in a street fight? I think let's focus on part one because the answer to number two is the internet. Social media would have a field day with that. Also, I don't know, what would the Secret Service do? Like,
just cheer. Just stand in a circle and like.
All right, Catherine, then let's start with you. You're going to answer here, Barack Obama or Donald Trump?
I'm going to go with president. I'm going to go with Obama for both of these answers. Obama definitely works out. He's scrappy. Trump, despite the recent health report, I think is not in as good a shape. So he's going to win the fight. I also think, you know, Obama was a bad president. Trump is a bad president. They're both bad presidents. I don't like them. I don't like presidents, actually. But this last 100 days or so of the crackdown on really the two things that I care about the most, which are free trade and free movement of people by Donald Trump, has pretty definitively put him in. Now, Obama deported a lot of people. We're going to talk about that, I'm sure. He was not as much of a champion of free trade as I would like, though he was part of the neoliberal global order that I sorely miss.
Wow. You love the neoliberal global order. I just want to make sure people heard that. Nick, what's your answer here?
They were both terrible in distinct ways. It's kind of like the Flaubert line about happy families and unhappy ones. All presidents make me unhappy in their own ways. Trump and Obama both overrode any kind of limits that they could get to on the presidency, on the executive branch. And then they each, just spent a ton of money and did a bunch of stupid things. So I don't feel a need to decide between them.
Welch, you have been asked to decide between them, Obama or Trump.
Yeah, I guess I have to tap this sign every week now. I'm against pundit scorecarderism. Scorecardism?
Scorecardery?
Scorecardery. I don't even understand
grading.
The impulse. It's alien to me in every way. And like certain parts of the human anatomy, everyone's got an opinion about presidents, and they're all idiosyncratic, and they all kind of smell equally bad. Mine is based on...
How many presidents have you smelled?
Zero.
That's a good question.
I smelled myself when I was president of Lakewood High School, Peter Suderman. Don't you forget it.
The way that Lakewood Matt Welch smelled in high school senior. Is a thing that I did not want to think about today, so
yes,
thanks a lot for that.
Like a mesh half shirt. Yeah, it's not good.
You smelled like California sunshine.
Old Spice, endurance, sports endurance, something like that.
Stuff I care about includes government spending. Trump spent more money in or added more to federal spending in his first 3.5 years than Obama did in his complete 8, and that was prior to COVID. That means something to me. I think Trump is a more corrosive character. He has been more momentous in upending the 7-decade America-led project towards global tariff reduction, which had been one of the bigger accomplishments in eradicating human poverty in that we've ever seen. He lies even more than Barack Obama did. kind of hard to do that, including about such consequential things as, I don't know, who won the election in 2020. He pardoned, didn't just commute the sentences of, but pardoned violent criminals who ransacked the Capitol building on January 6, 2021 in a protest that after a protest that he spoke at and told them to give him hell. It's just not a great basket of things that that Trump has done. So I don't have any problem saying that I personally think that Trump is worse than Obama. But it's all a weird question. And Obama, I think, would still win. He's a bit of a smoker. So I presume he's faster on his feet and still has some wind. But he's always been known to play really dirty at basketball. He's a fouler and an elbower. So if he stays light on his feet and uses the jab, I think Trump's
better. I mean, you've seen Trump in the Worldwide Wrestling Federation
True.
Ring. He knows how to handle himself with a chair. So
I know, but it's just a question of, like, does he have the kind of speed to corner
Obama? No, he doesn't. He doesn't have to. He's like the Blob in the X-Men, the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. Like, every punch into him, he absorbs and then pushes back.
Okay, but in my mind, does Elon Musk show up behind Trump wearing a, like, Iron Man-style exoskeleton and
which
kind of
immediately
show up at the last
malfunctions
minute?
Because his son pours his sippy cup on the ankle
just
or something?
Think instead, we need to consider all the possibilities.
Yeah. He wears the Matt Welch High School mesh half shirt.
Yeah, that is
showing off his
dazzling
flat tire.
If we're gonna relate this back to the X-Men, this question obviously.
I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
Obviously,
yeah,
is
apologies.
Just the same question that comic book fans have been asking all of my life, which is, what happens when the Juggernaut, who cannot be stopped once he starts moving, runs into the Blob, who cannot be moved once he sits? Don't know.
That's
you don't
a,
know.
It is a good question.
Yeah.
And then you layer on the idea that the Juggernaut, you know, created Obamacare and, you know, had a terrible foreign policy. And the Blob created, you know, mRNA vaccines that he disowns. It gets very confusing.
It is very confusing. And this is a good segue for me to remind you that we love to answer your questions about public policy, presidents, and the X-Men. To send your short, succinct, pithy, and otherwise not very long questions to podcasts@reason.com. That's podcasts@reason.com. All right. Now it is time for our lightning round. One of the problems with covering the news in the second Trump term is that there is just too much of it. So from my perch on Mount Moderation, I'm going to play Zeus and zap each one of you with a question. Let's start with Matt Welch. Pete Hegseth, the Secretary of Defense, seems to have shared Houthi attack plans with just about everyone in Washington, except me, feeling a little left out. Politico published a buzzy piece from a former DOD spokesperson calling for Hegseth's ouster, and for somebody who says he's a big supporter of Hegseth. So did the Trump team finally find out about his tattoos and decide it's time for him to go?
I have no idea what's happening at the Pentagon. And the sad news and the more unexpected news is neither does Pete Hegseth, apparently, which is not a great thing for someone who heads up the Department of Defense. One of the criticisms that some of us had of Hegseth when he was a nominee was that he hadn't shown any ability to manage an organization, which seems to be something that one might want to do. He'd managed a nonprofit poorly from all published reports. All of his senior advisors seem to be out the door. He's got a new Signal chats and Jesse Single chats. It's all very confusing. It seems like he's probably out the door, though who knows. But whatever is happening over there, it's very not good for both morale and organization. And so, who knows, man.
Nick, let's check in on tariffs. They're raising prices already. Just if you're shopping online, you can see it. There's a Goldman Sachs estimate showing Trump's tariffs could cost something like $90 trillion to the American economy over the years. Turns out the only reason we got the pause that we got was because Scott Bessent distracted Peter Navarro with a meeting on the other side of the White House. Just seems like a really well-run operation over there at 1600 Pennsylvania. What do you think of all this?
It's like was saying to somebody, it's like a Three Stooges short, but a Shemp, where literally somebody is kind of, you know, giving Peter Navarro, or as I like to call him, Ron Vara, his fake source, who was a Harvard-educated military vet that he incessantly quoted in his stupid, innumerate books about trade policy over the years. But, they slip a diuretic to Ron Vara, and then he goes into the bathroom, and then the other guys bum rush the Oval Office and get Trump to suspend the tariffs. I mean, this is the plausible account of why the pause happened when it did. Not a good way to run trade policy. When you look at whether it's Goldman Sachs or a group like the Tax Foundation has looked at, the various levels of Trump tariffs being implemented over the next decade, and they're showing anywhere from 0.3% to 0.5% decline in GDP over the time that they're in force, which is not good. The tariffs are a bad idea. They're not going to get better the longer that Trump pretends that they're good. The idea that tariff policy is being, kind of aborted and restarted because of this kind of behavior is just abominable.
Well, the good news is the singularity is nigh, maybe, coming about. Everything's going to be free. We're just going to have everything we want in the world finally, because there is a new ChatGPT model. Tyler Cowen says it's AGI, Artificial General Intelligence. So, Catherine, should we just quit and let the robots do everything already?
I'm so ready. As you well know, I am happy to be replaced by a robot. Maybe I already have been. You guys don't even know.
Are you going to, like, there's going to be a moment on the podcast when you're just going to take
off my face. Yeah, I'm not even, I'm a digital figment of everyone's imagination. I think that we are in the phase of AI that I spent a long time sort of dwelling in with respect to space travel, which is we're 18 months from the big thing happening in for like 10 years, maybe more. We were always 18 months from private space launch. We were always 18 months from going back to the moon. We're always 18 months from whatever it is that is your dream for this new technology. The report that just came out is very much a 18 months from now, everything will be different type report. And maybe it will be. Maybe this is the 18 months that matters. On the other hand, maybe we are just going to make slow and incremental progress toward an exciting new future. And one day we will be there and we will not remember when the turning point actually was. I think that is the most likely thing, because that tends to be how humanity rolls.
Can correct something Catherine said, we won't be going back to the moon. I've watched Candace Owens recently. We will be going to the moon for the first time, because all those NASA Apollo trips were fake and gay. So
I'm so grumpy, by the way, about how rude everyone was about the lady flight.
Yeah, I agree with you.
Like, why are people haters? I get that Katy Perry is cringe. I get that. Yeah. But like, it was like Oprah's friend and Katy Perry and a cool lady with some petri dishes all went to space. It was fun.
We didn't even pay for it. It's good. Yeah, it's like I agree with you. I don't understand the the real animus against that.
Their hair was
It was that or a spa day.
Yeah. See, right there, you just set feminism back somehow with that thought. Or maybe Jeff Bezos did. We don't know.
The very best little AI tidbit from the last week or two was somebody who tweeted something like, how much money has the OpenAI, which runs ChatGPT, spent on processing people's requests in which they say please and thank you to the ChatGPT? And Sam Altman just responds like, millions, very well spent, because you never know. You never know, folks. 18 months from now, you might have wished that you said please and thank you.
My children are very, very committed to being polite to the robots for explicitly this reason. And honestly, if it's teaching my children to be polite, fine. I accept.
The robots are good, folks. All right, let's move on to our final segment. What you been watching, reading, otherwise consuming in the cultural realm, our recommendations. Let's start with Nick Gillespie.
So I watched the new season of Black Mirror, which is available on Netflix. I would say about half of the episodes were decent to good. The other half were really mediocre, especially the first one. So power through that, but it's a real paint-by-numbers kind of vision of a future where everybody has to shift to various kinds of digital enhancements to stay alive, and then the poor get squeezed out because that's, you know, how capitalism works. It creates a bunch of things that become necessities, and then they kill or really degrade the quality of life of the people who would be on their subscription plans. You know, it all makes perfect sense. I was taken in watching it, Louis Anslow, who is the proprietor of the Substack and the Twitter feed, The Pessimist Archive, had a great piece recently in The Guardian calling Black Mirror over the arc of its, this is its seventh season, over the arc of its time so far as pessimism porn. And he talks about how the episodes consistently miss the lessons of Prometheus and try to get us to fear the future more than the past. I think that essay captures my disappointment in Black Mirror, even as, you know, when the season came out, I basically, you know, binged it, you know, in a day and a half. So it's fun and interesting TV, but it's probably as endlessly annoying and frustrating as the near future is going to be.
I haven't seen the latest season, but I did see somebody saying something to the effect of, man, this show's really British, and you can tell because they think of like normal parts of the American capitalist experience as extreme expensive luxuries, because the British economy has just like really
fallen
behind.
They're out here being
the
like, in the future, your
decade.
Clothes will dry.
Wow. Never too soon.
Wow.
All right, Catherine, what do you got for us?
So the male members of my household were out of town last week. So my daughter and I had a little movie night and we watched Legally Blonde. You guys,
yeah.
It holds up. Oh my God. What a banger. I cannot say good enough things about this movie. This is, the source of the totally excellent, by the most famous line of the movie, Reese Witherspoon as a, sorority girl gets into Harvard Law, bumps into the ex-boyfriend she is looking to make jealous, and he says, you got into Harvard Law, and she says, what, like it's hard? Classic line. Two thoughts about this movie relevant to our listeners. One, we do see an admissions committee making the decision to let our protagonist in, and they do so on the strength of a video application in which she is in a sparkly bikini, and they say amongst themselves, well, we are looking for more diversity in the student body. So right there, the seeds of much of our destruction. Also, big Me Too plot. I had kind of forgotten about the Me Too plot. The partner of the law firm lays the hand on the knee, and Elle Woods is not having it. Finally, and always, an important lesson for those of us who might think that we are not like other girls. Actually, maybe being like other girls is the path to happiness, is the lesson of this movie. And it's not wrong. So for the three lady listeners, that one as well.
Matt Welch.
So as we all know, Friday was the semi-quincentennial of Paul Revere's A Midnight Ride.
We did know that.
Mm-hmm. Yelling that the regulars are coming out. Which is what he actually said. And then Saturday, therefore, was the
regulars was not like pre-America for normies, was it?
No, that's what they called the Redcoats. Saturday, therefore, was the semi-quincentennial. I'm going to start memorizing that word. Of the Revolutionary War inaugurating battles of Lexington and Concord. So I marked the occasion by doing something that I almost never do, which is listen to a podcast. And in this case, I listened to The History of the Americans. Great podcast by a recent supporter, a roundtable listener, Jack Henneman. Terrific guy. And he did a two-part sidebar called The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere. About, 50 minutes each episode, relying pretty heavily on David Hackett Fisher's Paul Revere's Ride and quoting from it, which just sounds like a wonderful book based on the quotations of it. And man, did I learn a lot of stuff. It was really great. Really appreciated sort of Jack's got a very nice voice. I'm now going to plot with my 10-year-old to listen to his entire History of the Americans from the beginning, if we can figure out a way to do it, because why not? Why are we even here? But this little sidebar, because he's usually in his normal routine, he's going chronologically and he's nowhere close to the Revolutionary War. So he just wanted to throw a little jab in there. But it really speaks to the fullness of Paul Revere himself, who's just a fascinating character, blacksmith. He was in all kinds of different organizations, the dispersed kind of networks of people trying not to overly interact with one another as part of the resistance in Boston. Just great, fascinating, granular. Check it out. History of the Americans, sidebar, The Midnight Ride of Paul Revere.
It's a great show.
Yeah.
Jack's great. If you have not seen on Twitter, someone from Boston did some really important Bostonian research on this and mapped all of the Dunkin' Donuts that Paul Revere could have gone to on his ride. Yeah. And it's just, it's so beautiful, right? There's like seven of them and there's like a Trader Joe's along the way. And it's like, oh, Paul Revere, if you ran that ride today, he could eat a lot of donuts.
Plenty of Dunkies on the way.
All right, for my recommendation, I watched Sinners. It's the new movie from Ryan Coogler. It's a vampire film set in the Jim Crow South, starring Michael B. Jordan in dual roles as a sort of Prohibition-era gangster who has just come down from Chicago, working with Al Capone, sort of pitting the gangs against each other. And he wants to set up a juke joint. And so the first hour of this movie is just him kind of bumming around Jim Crow South, picking up people to work at the juke joint, or I guess him, Michael B. Jordan's two characters. And it's this sort of like Seven Samurai-like bit where you just kind of get to know each of these people and their milieu and their place in the world. And then finally, you get out to this juke joint, which is abandoned mill that they bought from the Ku Klux Klan, right? And it's like, this is going to be their place that they can finally have a little bit of respite at the end of the day, that they can drink and they can party and they can celebrate and play music. And what happens? Vampires show up. It's pretty bad. Vampires.
Every time.
Yeah, it's bad every time when the vampires show up. But what
they
want to
turn it into an emo club?
Kind of they do. So the vampires show up and they're Irish and they're playing Irish jigs and they're playing like kind of cheesy Irish jigs. But what happens is one of the people who they bring on to play the cousin of the Michael B. Jordan characters is a kind of a magical blues guitarist whose blues magic opens up portals into time and space. And there is this absolutely magical sequence that happens in the middle of the movie in which he starts playing. And it's truly a fantastic song, which is often hard to do in a movie, right? You're sort of writing original music and it's like you need this moment to like really carry you. And the songs are often, it's a great song, but in the juke joint, in the club, Coogler just stages this amazing sort of this like cross-temporal party in which you see 1,000 years of black music kind of all coalescing, right? So you see these Afrofuturist like guitarists with flying Vs and like kind of crazy sci-fi outfits and DJs and rappers, but also like old tribal drums guys playing together. And it's just this like great fusion of like black music across time. And so he's making, on the one hand, a movie that is really just Seven Samurai meets From Dusk Till Dawn. And I can't emphasize how much the final hour of this movie really just resembles the crazy Quentin Tarantino, Robert Rodriguez, George Clooney movie from the 90s, From Dusk Till Dawn, which has maybe the best three performances by Cheech Marin. I think maybe it's Chong. Anyway, he plays three roles ever. there's this crazy, just like ridiculous blood-soaked vampire film, but it's also a movie about Black identity and art, about integration, about like thinking about like what your place in the world is. And maybe there are times when you want to keep your art as your own and sort of, and mix only, and like only sort of keep it within its own lineage. And so it's, on the one hand, super culturally smart and interesting, and this great musical middle set piece in the middle of the film. And on the other hand, just this fantastic, gory, rip-roaring, violent, kind of crazy, bizarre, pulpy vampire film. It's uneven. It's imperfect. He tries to do too much. But man, I kind of loved it. And the more I think about it, the more I like it. Okay, that is our show. Before we go, Nick, do you have anything that you want to announce to us? Any events you want to tell us about?
Yeah. We've got a bunch of events in New York City coming up, including a Reason Speakeasy, a live taping of the Reason Interview podcast with Bob Rosenkrantz, who's the founder of Open to Debate, a billionaire success story who's written a great book called The Stoic Capitalist. And we've got a sold-out Soho Forum debate about immigration with Alex Naras of the Cato Institute, arguing in favor of more immigration versus Dave Smith, part of the problem, arguing against or in favor of mass deportations and less immigration. You can get on the wait list for that, and you can also live stream it, but go to reason.com/events to check that out, as well as the latest on the big debate about libertarian practitioning that Andrew Heaton of Reason will be doing with Eric Brakey of the Free State Project up in New Hampshire at the end of this month. Go to reason.com/events for more information.
That sounds great. Before we go, we do want to say thanks and give a big shout out to some generous supporters: Nathan Fonda, Samantha Donahue, David Daly, James Drabina, Eric Davidson, Chris LaChance. Thank you so much for making this podcast and everything we do at Reason possible. As always, if you like this podcast, you can support us by going to reason.com/donate. That's reason.com/donate. And remember, if you want to work for the Reason Roundtable, if you are a big enough super fan that you listen all the way to the end every week and you want to help make the Reason Roundtable happen, well, you can send a cover letter and a resume to jobs@reason.com. That's a cover letter and a resume, both things, to jobs@reason.com. Thank you so much for listening. Reason Roundtable will return.